take that as our cue. Welcome, everybody. What's first incredibly obvious is that I am Sean Kershaw, the executive director of the Citizens League, not Steve Seal, the host for this. We gave Steve an excused absence over the birth of a little baby boy named Benjamin. So you can go to his Facebook page and check that out. So family's doing well, just a little earlier birthday than was expected. So the title tonight is Can Design Save the World? Or if design is the answer, what is the question? In many of our conversations here at Policy and a Pint, design has come up again and again within the policy conversations, and we thought, let's just take it on directly. And judging from the response we had tonight, which is one of the fastest sign-ups we've ever had, I think we're going in the right direction. So we have a fantastic panel tonight as a part of the conversation, and my role is going to be to kick it off and let it go. You can join the conversation also on Twitter. It's hashtag PolicyPint. So again, if you are on Twitter, you can follow us at hashtag PolicyPint. We've got a great panel tonight, and I'm going to introduce them and then put out the first question. On my right, Bernard Kniff is the professor and chair of design at the Minneapolis College of Art and Design. He's originally from Merthyr Tydfil,
correct,
South Wales, and has lived in the United States since 1991. He's the former co-chair of design at the Maryland Institute of College of Art, where he collaborated with the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health on a joint design coalition which paired students with neighborhood groups to create meaningful, powerful messages on health and wellness topics. On my left is Tom Fisher. He's a professor of architecture and dean of the College of Design at the University of Minnesota. Educated at Cornell University in architecture and Case Western Reserve University in intellectual history, he previously served as the regional preservation officer at the Western Reserve Historical Society in Cleveland, the historical architect of the Connecticut State Historical Commission, and the editorial director of Progressive Architecture Magazine. And on my far left is Bill Thornburn. He's the CEO and chief design officer of Thornburn Group. He started with a fine arts degree from Minneapolis College of Art and Design. He worked a few years in the agency setting before becoming design director for an old company called Dayton Hudson Marshall Fields, which we all remember. He opened up the Thornburn Group in 1994 with a pioneering vision the design firm could take a greater role in brand development. He's been honored to work with some of the world's most prestigious brands, Coke, Harley-Davidson, Disney, Formica, VH1, United Colors of Benetton, Nike, Porsche, Lacoste, Capitol Records, and Hallmark, just to name a few. So we've got a fantastic panel, a fantastic audience. And just to kick things off, I'll ask each of them the same question, and I'll start with you, Tom. What do we mean by design, and why all the interest suddenly in design?
Well, I think that many of us think of design as about aesthetics, as about the sort of look of things that we use every day. But I like Charles Eames's definition of design, which is design is a way of arranging elements to accomplish a particular purpose. Because I actually think that design goes way beyond all of the physical things that we think of as being designed, cars, computers, buildings, clothing, all of that, to actually pervade our lives. I think everything in this room has been designed, and yet most of us in this room have gone through an educational system that doesn't even offer courses in this thing that affects us every moment of our lives. And so I think that design is this fundamentally important thing that affects us. We don't understand it. And I think as a result, a lot of design is really bad as a result of that. I also like Scott Adams' definition of design. He goes, creativity is allowing yourself to make mistakes. Design is knowing which ones to keep. And I think that that's also part of it, which is design is this kind of iterative process of testing, prototyping, critiquing, trying again and again. It's why all our students stay up late. That process, though, actually ends up creating things by good designers that work really well, that are beautiful and functional and appealing to us.
Fantastic. Bill, do you do that question? How would you define it?
Well, I was sitting around a few weeks ago, and someone told me that design was the byproduct of the Industrial Revolution. And I thought that was interesting, but I disagree. I think design is about thinking, and I think it transcends time and geography and really discipline. And what makes a designer unique is that a designer is approaching the world from a point of view that thinking is the medium of choice, if you will. And so when I think about design, I think about ideas and vision and possibilities. I think about bringing order to disorder and beauty to chaos. I think about attraction. I think about connection. I think about inspiration. I think about elevation. And I think about, from a communication point of view, a language that transcends borders. As we talk tonight, a lot of those ideas will come out, but you know, I refuse to go to the idea that design is an artifact. It manifests itself in that, but definitely it's a process and a thought and thinking.
I think I'm going to have a designed crick in the neck from speaking this way. I think for me, design is big and blurry for a messy world. I believe in the proposition that design has value, and that value is rooted or centered in community. And I also believe in design as a participatory process where everybody is sitting at the grown-up table. That's all I've got.
So why? I'll pose a question that I wonder if part of the reason that design is in people's minds and in the conversation, and not just because a famous designer passed, is because we are stuck trying to solve problems and don't feel like we're doing a very good job at it. And is there something about design that helps in that process? I mean, what are the key things that, Bernard, I'll go back to you, that design brings to the table? Ooh. Uniquely?
Well, I think it's sort of like anyone who is a designer in the room, and anyone who's had the misfortune of being around a designer.
Or married to one.
It's like being with a designer is like visiting the dentist. We just drill and drill and drill and drill. And the sort of classic designer joke is, how many designers does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is, well, does it have to be a light bulb? You know, and that can have its strengths and that can have its weaknesses. But I think what we do really well is we try as best we can to understand what it is that we're trying to communicate. So if we're trying to do something working with doctors, then we try to understand what it's like to be a doctor, mm-hmm, as best we can.
Mm-hmm. And then drill. Yeah.
What do you think design brings to the table?
Well, now I guess I'm feeling more obsessive compulsive after that, Bern. Because it is a tenacity. And I love the idea of empathy. Mm. And, you know, design is meant for people. And you had talked about why now. And it's kind of an interesting question because, you know, in my career, I've watched design go from trade publications to business publications, which is a good thing, and then to ultimately consumer publications. And, you know, everybody seems to be talking about design, but it has been part of the global solution approach since, you know, as long as mankind goes. And I think this idea that it's more relevant now is a good question, and my personal feeling is I don't believe there's any more problems in the world than there was 400 years ago, 3,000 years ago. I think that culture is finally catching up with the designer. And if you look at, mega trends from, agricultural economy to the industrial economy to the technology economy, we're at the beginning now of what some are referring to as the creative economy. And as much as design hasn't changed, it may in certain mediums and certain aspects to modern living, the thinking is still there. And I think what's happening now is that it's getting so much more popularity because culture is catching up with it. And we're getting a light shine on us that we've never had before. And so that's my own personal theory.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's possible that we have no more problems than we used to have, but I do think the nature of the problems we have now are different, which is we're stuck with a lot of the wicked problems that haven't really lent themselves to sort of singular solutions by single disciplines. And I think that that's actually where design is most valuable, is bringing together a wide range of disciplines to solve a really hairy problem that is tough to solve. And so I think it is increasingly viewed as a way to address these seemingly insoluble problems. I mean, one of the things we were talking about just before coming up here is that in our college, we're talking about the fact that design is moving into its invisible century. And the 20th century is often viewed by science as science's invisible century, which is a lot of the main discoveries in science were invisible. The human genome, human psychology, space-time, and relativity, and all these things that scientists couldn't actually see and touch, but were the great discoveries of science. And we think that design is moving into that world, which is, in addition to designing all this stuff that we see around us, that design is increasingly being applied to policies and procedures and protocols and organizations and systems and infrastructures and all the things we don't see. And that is where I think a lot of the discovery is going to happen, and that's where I think design is actually going to be viewed as even more valuable to the world.
Well, could you, any of you jump in with examples? I mean, you've each, I think, done work in this area of where design thinking, so the elements of design that you had talked about earlier, were applied to saving the world, as we talked about, or solving a real-world problem.
Well, you could look at, architecture for humanity as one. Project H is another one. Project M, they're all letters of the alphabet. Project M is another, I suppose, small example of that.
So what were those projects?
Well, we're working in Haiti with Architecture for Humanity and designing schools for kids and all the orphans rendered orphans by the earthquake. And we're also designing clothing so that they can sort of restart their clothing industry. So, I think one of the things that's different and great about the current generation of students is that they actually do want to change the world. They actually want to use design as a vehicle to make a difference in people's lives globally. And that is a remarkable change and a great one, I think.
And I think what Tom is talking about is, if you go back to design thinking, is that he's talking about complex systems. And I'm really glad he brought that up. Part of what it means to be a designer is that you create out of dispersed knowledge bases. And for me, on a corporate level, I would go into a situation and understand the vision, values, of mission, which could be reams and reams of paper, and then distill it down into something the size of a quarter, and we call that a logo. But, whether you're an architect or a graphic designer, the ability to think through complexity, and I really like that, as far as the spotlight on design. We're currently working with National Geographic on the opportunity of and it's their educational department on the opportunity of changing the way you teach. And the idea comes from, and I'll just kind of walk through our process and how we think about it, and that is, you know, when I was growing up, there was a sense of learning through audible. You know, you listened, you read, you took a test. What they found in education is that kids actually learn on three levels. It's audible, it's experience, and it's visual. And if you take those trends and then you combine them with what's happening in the digital world with the ability to connect socially and have a conversation about what you're learning, the ability to be engaged with the ideas that come to life, you know, I'm not going to say like a game, but if you look at a lot of the current books happening with iPod, and the ability to have much more hands-on, empowered approaches to an understanding of an idea, and then you put it into the context of, you know, this idea of empathy, of bringing it to a student. The students are different in Texas than they are in Maine. They're different in the urban parameters than they are in the rural and suburban. And so our challenge is to take all of these dispersed ideas and bring them together to create a larger platform for learning and a better platform for learning. And that's, you know, when you talk about practical solutions, that's how we think. And
I mean,
that's,
Bill, don't you think this environment itself could be the classroom of the future? I mean, it's immersive, it's experiential, it's conversational, it's relaxed. I mean, I actually think that here you go.
Well... Welcome.
Thanks for your tuition. Talk a little bit about. So let's keep going with the practical notion here. If whether it's a particular policy problem, you've talked, Bernard, about being at the table. Who else needs to be at the table with designers? What are those skills or those attributes that need to be there for design to succeed?
I think if we're going to affect real change that's sustainable, then design cannot save the world on its own or through bad typography. I think there needs to be social work, medical work, legal work, and policy work for a start. And I think that's where the real change can happen. I think for the longest time, there's been some sense of elitism with design and a self-centered nature of design. And I think, you know, the status quo is unacceptable or unsustainable. And we were facing sort of peak oil, global warming. I mean, governments who can't do what they were elected to do. You know, and I think this is where the future is going to be. It's going to be with these kinds of discussions, building from these discussions that will affect change.
What, the way I would answer that is that I think what designers need are others who are open to new ideas. I think one of the greatest frustration designers have, I mean, is this sense that some people have, which is, well, we've never done it that way before. Mm-hmm. Design is really about envisioning alternative futures, possibilities that don't yet exist. And if you're in a context where other people are open to that and exploring that, then it works. If they say, no, you know, prove it, and no designer can prove it, initially, then it cuts down the opportunities.
What would you say is the role of inspiration in design? I mean, in either in capturing that imagination or in being invisible to people and yet guiding their actions?
Go ahead, Bill.
Well, I think making a difference and empathy. I mean, you know, what inspires us every day is to connect. And you know, I was listening to Tom, and I thought, and it's kind of cheating because we've had this conversation before, but what if there's a design czar? And, you know, what if there was a way from a communication process that you could understand the issues and the ideas at hand? How would it make you feel? Would you feel more engaged, more empowered, more understood? If you could take away the smokescreen of media sensationalism and ideas that are tribal and not pragmatic, what would that do to democracy? And I'm speaking just from a communication point of view. What if you could distill legislation down into something as understandable as a subway map?
You know, one of the things... there you go. You know, one of the things we... that's sort of following on that, Bill, that we're... I mean, policy is the name of this evening, right? And, you know...
And a pint.
And a pint, yeah. Well, the pint is given. But this idea that one of the... I see the flaws in public policy is that it doesn't go through the kind of iterative prototyping and testing process that designers do. That too often our elected officials have an idea, they write a law, it gets passed, and they try it out on all of us. And it, you know, often has all kinds of unintended consequences. So then they write another law to deal with that and another one to deal with that. And, you know, from a design perspective, that just seems totally bizarre. Because what designers do is we put out an idea, we prototype it, and then we're relentless in critiquing it. Yeah. And you got to do it again, and you got to do it again. And it's only after about the sixth or seventh time does it start to get to a point where you want to try it out on other people. So if we took design thinking and folded it into policy, I think we'd have much better policy as a result.
What is the design equivalent of No Child Left Behind, then, you could say?
Or exactly.
Now, I just want to remind the audience that very soon we'll be going to your questions, that part of the fun of the Policy in a Pint experience is we want to hear from you and your questions. So in just a few minutes, we'll be going to that. And again, if you're tweeting or following along, we are at #PolicyPint. What do you see, if you could pick a challenge or something that would you could dive into that you think is you're passionate about, you think is a great opportunity from the notion of sort of practical real-world policy, what would you want to jump into that you think is a great opportunity to bring that design skill to the table? Ooh. Where would you start?
Global poverty.
Yeah.
Global poverty?
Yeah, I was poverty. About... Exactly. I think I would say that designers actually only affect maybe 5-10% of the world's population. It's the other 90% who are left unserved. And the design community's got to figure out how to, you know, really help address the needs of all 7 billion people. And maybe even other species and the planet itself. And so I think that's our challenge as a discipline.
And I think the Times recently had a piece there talking about housing and situations in Asia where they were at applying design, physical design, to that. What are the challenges?
I don't know. On the one hand, you know, being a designer sees a wealth of possibilities. That's what we do, is bring possibilities, I think. And then my Welsh angst would come out and say, well, education costs. So how can we affect change if tuition is through the roof and students coming out with, you know, I think, you know, that's the elephant in the room that no one wants to talk about.
Yeah, another one I would say, I had a grad student who did this project that lived 100 days without oil, and she's sort of getting ready as a designer to think about this world that we are about to go into where oil will still exist, but it'll be so expensive we can't afford it. And, you know, what we realized in the process of her doing that thesis is that everything is going to have to get redesigned. I mean, not just the gas in our cars, but our clothing, our food, our environments, where we live, how we live. And so we're at the edge of a kind of design revolution as some of the factors we've just assumed are always going to be there are no longer there.
I mean, it seems to me, Bernd, even in your example, that there's a design challenge inherent. We're looking at post-secondary education as a policy topic. I mean, so how do you... there are lots of questions around that. I'm sure there's a light bulb question in there somewhere to say... Are we thinking about it the right way? Because I certainly agree that that's a challenge, and yet we've got to...
And I think, again, the answer would be to let's, you know, if that's the problem, let's select the people at the table who are going to be able to address that problem and effect change.
Well, I think we have a creativity crisis in education in this country, which is that, you know, at the very time when we need more creative people, our K-12 system drums creativity out of people. Yeah. And in fact, one of the things I think we find as design educators is we have to sort of help our students relearn what it was like to be on the playground in kindergarten, to have that kind of playful sense of creativity that K-12 education told them was somehow wrong or bad to have.
Do you think that design can compensate for people's limits in their decision-making abilities as well as sort of maximize that? I mean, are there ways in the policy challenges, whether it's healthcare or education, that design can help compensate for just the normal failings that people have in the decision-making process? Can we sort of engineer a better outcome with design?
Well, I think from a communication point of view, absolutely. And, you know, and I think you could go global with it, too. And I think one of the trends you see going on right now is that design and art are taking on a new role in reinventing a global language. And it's because it's visual and it transcends borders, it's collectively has the ability to bring a lot more people into the conversation, a lot more people as, you know, part of the discussion and part of the solution. I mean, collaboration is the new currency, and being able to share and share ideas, and I'm speaking from a communication designer, to be able to share and share ideas and connect people and engage people and inspire people, and to kind of transcend a lot of the barriers within communication, I think is the starting point, because the solution is going to come from most likely the most unlikely place. And I say that because I think there's so much restriction in the more obvious places, so much dogma that, exactly what Tom's talking about, this playful, wonderful nature of discovery to maybe someone who is more innocent, more naive, and less restricted. And again, that's unencumbered by fact, but it sure sounds good.
That's your design prerogative.
Yeah.
We are, like I said, excited to move from two questions. So the rules of the questions here are that your question needs to be in the form of a question, not a speech. And the two, we've got Todd and Matt in the room, and Todd over here is going to go first with a question from the audience, and Todd gets to hold the mic. And who would like to go? Okay, I've got lots of questions up here. Okay, we've got one right over here.
Okay. Is a comment considered a question? I mean, asking you to comment on something. I'm wondering if you were talking about why is design coming to the forefront now, and I wonder if it isn't... based on the democratization of design through the availability of technological tools that catalyze the process of iterative refinement, especially as design becomes more intangible, as it was mentioned. Consider the changes in documents produced that not only are formatted for more accessibility, but include infographics created easily from easily accessible sources that previously were unavailable, and that's all... you know, technological tools that are commonly available now.
Yeah. I think there's no question we're in the age of the amateur, and that you're right. The digital environment has enabled people who were unable to do a lot of things that designers do, all of a sudden are able to do it. You know, design your own website, design a printed page. And so I think that that's good. Although I would argue that, you know, the issue really is, follows in what both Byrne and Bill were saying, is design is also a thought process. It's not just about the ability to make something look good. And it's that thought process that may be more important than anything.
Okay. Oh, am I on? Okay. Oh, I can't touch it. Okay. I just have a question about... entering design into public policy when it comes to, very specifically, when we're talking about bridges and going over nature preserves and how design has not been part of that discussion. Would that change the discussion if we're putting a beautiful Calatrava over the St. Croix and not, you know, trying to stick it to, you know, a 6th district senator that we don't want to approve of the, you know, big, huge bridge going across to a nature preserve?
Maybe you picked the wrong designer. I mean, you know, for me, it's sort of like design is political and design is cultural. I mean, I cannot separate those two things for me. And sort of like, I don't know whether the designer was brought at the wrong time into your conversation, but I think it's something to be said about picking the right person and bringing them at the right time in the process will activate the very thing that you were trying to get. You know, it's difficult sometimes for designers to know what part they play.
Yeah, and I think following on that, I mean, one of the things increasingly I see in the design discourse is this question of ethics, and that there is this issue of when does the designer tell a client, well, no, that's just the wrong thing to do. You shouldn't put that bridge there. And I think that part of that is that the design community needs to show that there really are alternatives, that too often our political process is win-lose. It's either you're going to get that bridge or there's not going to be a bridge. Well, you know, actually, there's a lot in between there. Maybe you get a bridge that is environmentally sensitive. Maybe it's a bridge to other species able to cross the river as well as people and cars. And so that, to me, gets back to the question of that the political context within which designers work often aren't open to out-of-the-box creative ideas that can actually find win-win solutions. It's not always about win-lose.
I mean, it's like, well, does it have to be a bridge?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Right. Right.
Insert that.
Thinking about, I mean, we are a global world, and with this intercommunication between all of us, isn't it time that we stop this political stuff and think of ourselves as inhabitants of one globe and one world and start designing to protect what is so special about the Earth and so wonderful about our diversity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, I just finished a piece for the Huffington Post about the healthcare system, and I'm somewhat critical of the politicians who keep arguing endlessly about who's going to pay for it, when in fact the healthcare industry is very busy redesigning itself and bringing designers into places like the Mayo Clinic to rethink how you deliver healthcare and greatly reducing the cost of that. And so I do think that when you get clients who are willing to listen and engage designers, designers can prove that we more than save whatever it is you pay us in more effective, more efficient ways of doing things.
Well, and I think, again, communication, you know, what you're talking about is an exchange of ideas. And I think that getting the accuracy of content and the accuracy of ideas unembellished gives us all the upper hand in how to make the right decisions. And I think, you know, from a communication designer's point of view, if we don't have authenticity to what we're saying, if we don't have, if it isn't based in truth, it's going to be exposed, and then it becomes, rejected. So I go back to, you know, the conversation, the accuracy of ideas, and the simplicity of being able to connect with those ideas through communication, and it should be simple.
Yes, I was educated as a political scientist, and I now work as a commercial artist. And I am wondering if you could give some advice to a person like me who is politically minded but deals every day with the simple, raw commercial art of we want to make money with the art that we're doing. I do advertisements, brochures, things that simply market to a company. And I would like some discussion about how we bring commercial interests and commercial companies to be more politically minded.
Go ahead, Brent.
You know, there's several things that come to mind. The first thing is for you to be maybe an agitator within the place that you work. You know, the second thing is to create your own grown-up table. And the third thing is to reach out to us, yeah, or to me right now.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing that I agree with you, Byrne, but one of the other things that came to mind is the fact that you have this set of skills that are very powerful. You can reveal things visually to people. And so I would encourage you to use your graphic art skills, your commercial art skills, to reveal the things that a lot of people in the public policy process want to keep hidden. The visualization of information is one of the great revolutionary acts. To follow what Byrne said, absolutely, you could transform public policy through your visualization skills.
Commercial guy, do you want to touch that one?
Well, sometimes you can't change the world. And there's certain things you can bring, and I don't mean to diminish, what we're talking about, but sometimes, all you get is a little bit of delight and a little bit of joy. And I think that sometimes that's okay. Take it.
Question in the back of the room.
Hi, I'd like to ask the panel about the separation between design and implementation. On the one hand, it seems like having design separate allows for more creativity and more flexibility, but it also seems that on the flip side, that it makes it more difficult for design to be rooted in pragmatism or in influencing the implementation of a project.
Talk about it again. The question is the connection between design and implementation, both specifically, and even Tom, I know you've talked, if you look back over failed implementations, what can you learn about design? But how do we make that connection at the table between the design and the implementation and maximizing the creativity and making it work?
It's sort of like, for me, it's sort of like how you define design. And with the work that I did in East Baltimore, predominantly African-American with the sixth grade reading level, drug and highest syphilis indices in the industrial world. And I mean, horrible, horrible place to live. But in many ways, what I learned was they were as much as a designer as I was. And design can be dance as a delivery. Design can be what... I mean, I don't know if that answers your question, but it's sort of like sometimes if we think that design is just a brochure or a leaflet, I think it's sort of like, and then looking at those to... Maybe it's not. It's like a common cold.
I do think there has been a sort of flaw in design education. We haven't focused enough on implementation, and we're very idea-oriented, thought-oriented. One of the things I've worked on recently is this idea that we've developed a series of design systems in this country that are what I call fracture critical, which is that everything goes perfectly, they work fine. But if one thing goes wrong, the whole thing falls apart. And of course, the I-35W bridge is a great example of that, right? One crack gusset plate, the whole bridge falls down. Well, that is a metaphor for what we have done repeatedly in the design of the systems that we all depend on. And so I think this is both a problem of a misguided notion of efficiency, but I also think it's a sense among the design community that, everything doesn't work perfectly, that we have to sort of design to assume there's going to be an element of failure, and we can't let things fail this way. So I do think that the question really gets at this gap between idea and implementation that is an issue for us.
And sometimes the process is the design.
Right.
My question is about education, which you've each talked about in your own different way. For the average person on the street who doesn't have a design background, I'm wondering kind of two things. What should that average person know about design, and what should that average person know how to do concerning design?
They should not think that the Helvetica movie is design, that's for sure.
Could you repeat that line again?
They should not look at the Helvetica movie and think that is design.
Why not?
Because it sucks. Okay. and because design is not defined by a typeface.
Yeah.
Never.
Well, I mean, my sense is, of course, all of us are making design decisions every day. When we buy clothing, when we decide where we want to live, how we want to you know, utilize the things we use. So we're all immersed in this designed environment. And so each one of us can make better decisions about that. You don't have to buy bad stuff. You don't have to buy stuff that doesn't function well, chairs that are uncomfortable or tables that wobble. And, demand better design. You don't have to live with so much junk that it gets foisted on us by a world that doesn't understand. And so that's what I think every one of us can do every day is just be better consumers and be more informed. And you yourselves can transform the design world as a result.
And I think one of the things that I would like, you know, the average person to know about design is in hearing all of the conversation about Steve Jobs and what he did and this meticulous drive and you know, the possibilities, those are all really great things. But the one thing that I want you to go away with is that design is emotional. And I think the greatest thing that Steve Jobs did was he brought emotion to an object. And through that emotion created attraction. And attraction created the ability to, you know, from an iPod, which is basic entertainment, to knowledge and information, which is what the computer is all about, to what Annie Leibovitz calls her favorite camera, the iPhone. Really, it's the connection that people have with these objects that really, if you look at what Steve Jobs did, is that he created a emotion to empowerment. And again, because of what it's done to creativity, what it's done to knowledge, what it's done to entertainment, I'm not so sure that would have happened as quickly as it happened and in the way that it happened if people weren't emotionally attracted to these objects that he made. So design is emotional.
I think for me, just to follow up, because I ducked the second part of your question about design and the average person, I mean, I just don't know. I mean, if the average person is on minimum wage and working two jobs, I mean, I don't know what design can even begin to do with that. But maybe it's a way for maybe, I mean, I think design needs to reach out and work with social workers to empower people like that and to give them a voice. And maybe that's our role there. But that's, I mean, that one is going to keep me awake for another 2 hours.
So just for the designers in the room, and then we're going to go to the back, was it the movie you didn't like or the Helvetica typeface you didn't like?
For me?
Yes.
Oh, dear. Does it have to be a movie?
We can pass on that.
I think both.
The back of the room.
Also regarding education, it was mentioned that there's a great need for or to empower our youth to think critically and creatively. And I was just wondering how design could effectively empower teachers in the classroom to essentially, since we are the strongest medium in which students are learning.
Well, it's interesting. You know, the research shows that about fourth grade, the creativity level of kids starts to plummet. So we're doing something around starting in fourth grade that is clearly not working. And but I do think that part of it, part of being an effective teacher to teach creativity is to not be afraid or not to sort of stomp down on crazy ideas that kids have. Because it's often those crazy ideas that, you know, lead to something else. I mean, Einstein was brilliantly creative, not because, you know, he was actually a really good mathematician. He just started to think about, well, what would the world look like if I was a particle moving at the speed of light? I mean, he just imagined himself as a particle. Or, you know, what would it feel like if I was falling off a roof and he realized that gravity and acceleration were the same thing? He just did mind games because he was incredibly creative. And that's what the world needs to do, is needs to cultivate creativity and not sort of think, oh, that's crazy, now get back to doing your math homework. But in fact saying, now let's think about where this crazy idea could take us.
I would also, to the teachers and the teacher who asked that, is to know that within you, you have that same creativity. And there's different ways of teaching. I have a daughter who, when she was in second grade, they spent 3 weeks creating the rainforest, every plant, every species, and they wrote it down, and the whole room became the rainforest. And they walked in one day, and it was destroyed. And, I mean, there were kids in tears, and, you know, no one knew what had happened. And after about 15 minutes, the teacher said, "Guess what? That's what's happening to the rainforest."
Oh, boy. Oh my gosh. That's the school of hard knocks.
But part of design is creating experiences. And, you know, sometimes that experience is, you know, you get to touch a business card that's printed on a letterpress and it makes your fingers smile. Sometimes that experience is these lights, you know, and what architects call candle feet, you know.
Foot
and
candles.
Foot candle. Thank you. And how we use them, and how you react to a space from a sense of comfort, from a sense of pleasing, and also from the energy, the way the economics and the energy of a space work. And so design thinking is about creating experiences, and I think that translates into a lot of our lives in different ways.
What we've got a question here from Twitter, and we can go back. Bernd, do you want to go ahead?
Is that Mr. Twitter?
I was just going to say that, to answer your question, I think, you know, the higher education sometimes does a piss-poor job with working with teachers, and I think, you know, if we're going to do anything, we need to be permeable and also nomadic, you know, so there should be you shouldn't be able to tell the difference between, you know, kindergarten and junior high and high school and higher education.
Taylor in Minneapolis has a great question on Twitter, and it's a follow-up on this, and I wanted to go there, and I'm glad he asked it better. What are the biggest barriers to design thinking in the creation of public policy? So let's just say that the three of you could imagine fantastic classrooms or psychologically disruptive classrooms, but powerful. That's all very nice. Let's go back to, again, to sort of what do you see as the barriers to having that have an impact on public policy?
Let's talk about what design thinking is first, so everybody understands, because it's kind of an overused term, but it's an important term. Design thinking, it has certain pillars to it. You know, we've talked about empathy. We've talked about creating experience. We've talked about systems and bringing things down to a narrow focus. We've talked about emotion, connecting, like all great art has always done.
Iteration.
Artistry, the craft. I mean, I think that artistry, to the question that was over here, and what sometimes all we get is the fact that we respect this person on the other end. We don't talk down to them, we talk up to them. And the fact that someone cared about something is really, really important, especially in this culture, which seems to be kind of fly-by comments, etc. It's about definition, defining something so it's how it's understood, and ultimately it's about innovation and looking at the world differently. So anyway, that I may have missed one or something, but if you think about all of those things being in one person, that's what a designer is. Yeah. And I think that's why what makes us, if we are special, it at least gives us that unique kind of point of view in the world, and kind of bringing it back to this idea of why now? What makes us relevant? How can we make a difference?
Well, I also...
Tommy, follow up on that, on the public...
Yeah, the public the policy thing. I mean, I think that, you know, Roger Martin, who's the dean of the business school at Toronto, said the worst words to use with any design is prove it. And I think, you know, as Daniel Pink has said, we've been through a century of left-brain thinking, that everything in the public policy arena is about number crunching and is basically trying to make arguments that dismiss the kind of imaginative imaginative leaps of right brain thinking. And I think that the problem is a lot of the problems we now face require imagination. And we've been taught that somehow it's bad to be imaginative in school. Somehow politicians feel like they can't be imaginative. They have to make arguments based on, how much are your taxes going to have to rise or not rise. I mean, it's a dreadfully dreary world that we live in public policy. I mean, it is the most boring, god-awful thing, and it creates problems for all of us. I mean, damn it. You know, and so the thing about this is that, getting creativity into public policy, asking people who are actually affected by public policy, the way designers ask people who use the things they design would transform the public policy realm.
And then the other thing I think for me is something that I use in the classroom quite a lot is sort of, excuses are not solutions, they're just excuses. And I think if you listen to what politicians say, it's mainly just excuses.
Yeah, it's for a lack of imagination. I mean, it's the point, do we need a light bulb? Do we need a bridge?
This, just as a boring point, in the Citizens League mission, we had for a while a notion that we build civic capacity, and had to add the word imagination because we realized that if people can't imagine
That's
doing
crazy.
Something different, that they did that. Anyway, but a real question.
So I'm an industrial engineer, and basically when I went into my education, I was told, you're strong in math and science, you should be an engineer. And so I went to engineering school. I didn't know which one I wanted to do. And I started out in electrical engineering, and I was about to drop out or change majors when someone pointed out to me that there's industrial engineering, which is like this big picture kind of engineering. You work with people, you think about all these different aspects, and you have so many different applications. And if you talk to most industrial engineers, they say, they kind of tell a story like that, where they were about to go a different direction when someone introduced them to this big picture engineering. And so I was just curious, given that it seems like we keep talking about how people need to know more about design and consider design, do you actually take any steps to start educating people? I do like some outreach events where, we talk about engineering and we make sure we always try and talk about the industrial engineering option instead of just like the typical engineering. So do you do anything like that?
No.
Well, we should. I mean, one of the problems is the design community is tiny. Most people never even meet a designer, and so you're not exposed to it through the media very much. But I think you're right. I think there are a lot of people who come to colleges like ours saying, I never knew I could actually make a living and have fun, But you can.
Do we have one last question here, and then we will begin to wrap up?
To a non-designer, how would you complete this sentence, design equals efficiency plus inspiration plus what?
Design equals efficiency plus inspiration plus...
imagination?
X.
Creativity, empathy, all the issues that Bill was saying.
A wonderful singing voice.
A fine Welsh accent.
Yes.
But the resolve to make a difference.
Yeah, right. It's about having a purpose and wanting to improve the world. I think most designers want to make the existing condition better in some way. You have to be driven to want to improve things.
We have one last question here, and then we'll wrap up.
One of the tenets of good design is simplicity, and you talk about how it affects public policy, and it seems to me the basis of religion and the way this country was founded is it was very simple, straightforward doctrine to which over the last 200 years we've continually to add and muddle that. And I'm also reminded when I was in a senior in we took an architecture class, and I took great umbrage with the architecture students being taught that everything was art. Wouldn't you also say that in some context of what you're talking about today, that everybody would be a designer and everybody can muddle great design by feeling they have to add to that design?
Mm-hmm. Works for me.
Yeah. Yeah, at some level, designing is one of the fundamental human activities. I mean, we're just a species that designs. We've always made shelter for ourselves and, you know, made clothing for ourselves and figured out how to live in communities. I mean, at some level, this is fundamental in all of us. And actually, one of the problems is that it has been professionalized by design schools like mine and taken away that ability of all of you to do something that is fundamental to being human. And I think that one of the transformations is that to see that we're no longer just we know everything and you know nothing is, in fact, that I think the design community is recognizing we need to facilitate and enable all of you to recognize that you are all designers too, and that you all have that creativity and imagination capacity within you, and that it has been drummed out of you in our educational system, and you are all rediscovering it.
But I think for me it's sort of like, If we are going to affect change, we have to realize that we're all in this together.
Right.
You know, that's the only way we can move forward.
Right. We've got to imagine a very different world than the one we've just been living in.
And we're
going to have to do that really quickly, because a lot of the assumptions behind the world of 10 years ago have totally changed. And so that's why it can't just be the few designers up here. It's got to be everybody thinking as creatively as possible about the future.
And if not...
Sorry, Bill.
It's more Helvetica movies for you.
Which there will be a side conversation with on. Bill, I was going to ask the last point being, what do you want people to take away tonight from this conversation? Now, I think you each might have answered that perfectly and don't touch it. But, Bill, do you want to end on that? What do you want people to take away tonight?
Well, first of all, a greater awareness of design. And, you know, second of all, to understand that through this awareness and respect, we get a greater foothold in what we do. And I think that a seat at the table and a voice is long overdue. And as we mature as a discipline, as we become more vocal as a discipline, as we become more recognized, as someone had said, democratization of design, you know, the conversation has spread like wildfire, that the benefits are for all of us and inclusive of all of us. And I guess that's what I'd like you to take away tonight, is that there's momentum here and there's something happening, there's something in the air. Maybe I'm not right with my mega trends, but the truth is that in the 20-year career I've had, design has changed drastically, and it's a really, really great time to be a designer. It's an exciting time to be a designer, you know.
And all of you can help us by demanding better design, you know? Yeah. Don't put up with the junk that is often given as somehow useful or functional or beautiful.
My parting thing that I'd like you to take is the Midwest is where the magic is, but can the Midwest meet that challenge? Stand up, Twin Cities.
All right. On that, let's a warm round of thank you for our guests, Bernard Knief, Tom Fisher, and Bill Thornburn, for being here tonight. Fantastic guests. Thank you.
Thank you.
Some final wrap-ups before you go. Again, if you're following along or if you want to go home and follow this, the hashtag for this was PolicyPint. We do want to continue talking with you and after tonight about design and other topics covered on NPR. So if you're willing to let the reporters from NPR ask you questions on occasion to inform their stories or programs, to share your expertise on design or whatever else is your passion, please take out your phones and text INSIGHT, INSIGHT, to 677-677. You'll get a message asking for your name and email and how you can be contacted and followed up. Also, we wouldn't be good nonprofits if both NPR, The Current, and the Citizens League didn't remind you of Give Minnesota and Give to the Max Day coming up this week. It's important, so please continue to support both of us. And want to thank, finally, the people who did the real work in pulling this off. Kat Beltman at the Citizens League, Ali Lozoff, Stephanie Curtis, Todd, and the other volunteers for NPR and The Current. Thank you very much for making this possible. And enjoy the evening and drive safe. And again, go to Facebook and wish Steve Seal happy regards. He'll be back.